Hello, this is Joe Cottonwood, reading from my novel, Famous Potatoes. Assisting me is the voice of Susan Walker. Episode 1. Leonard and Clyde, just out of jail. Clyde picked his nose with a tenpenny nail. Leonard read a Bible, said, "Hear me, O Lord. Take me to heaven in this 49 Ford. Mother America, what have you done? All of your children are out on the run. Oh, Mother America, say, can you see? Life is so short, we got to be free." Suburbia. I was a nice boy from the suburbs. In high school, my best friend was named John. We were good students, near the top of our class. At night, we stole signs. It became a ritual for us. I borrowed my father's Chevy. John swiped his mother's whiskey. We cruised, grabbed a sign, cruised some more. We grabbed so many that we ran out of places to hide them. We gave them to our classmates. One way for the scholar. Speed limit for the slow learner. No trespassing for the shy one. Yield for the nice girl. Do not enter for the virgin. For sale for the bad girl. Alcoholic beverages prohibited for the football captain. We became connoisseurs. We aimed for the special prize. "Please do not walk on graves" from the military cemetery, or "Try us, we're not expensive, we just look that way" from a motel, or "Shriver" from the driveway of Sergeant Shriver, the director of the Peace Corps who lived a few miles from us in a wealthier part of the suburbs. The Shrivers had a horse that kept jumping the fence around their yard and trampling the neighbors' gardens. We figured we were striking a blow for the common man by stealing their sign. John and I came from one-car families. Worse yet, one old car with chipped paint, big tail fins, many dents. And we had to mow lawns and shovel snow for pocket money, while it seemed that all the other kids had their own cars and a fat weekly allowance. It brought us closer, feeling poor. Our sign-stealing days ended the night we tried to chop down the Coppertone ad. We were hacking away at this mammoth billboard with a picture of a dog pulling down the little girl's bathing suit and exposing her precious white fanny. I forget what we were planning to do with it. A police car pulled up, and we were too drunk to run. It was quite a scene at the station when our parents came down. My dad was confused. He had no idea what he was supposed to do. My mother was embarrassed, for herself, not for me. John's dad was outraged. He was shoving John around like a kid trying to start a fight. John's mother, a semi-alcoholic, thought the whole evening was simply hilarious. The police were annoyed. There were no charges. We promised never to do it again and agreed to drop by for a few chats with the youth counselor. The youth counselor turned out to be Emmett Godwin, probation officer, according to the black lettering on the frosted glass of the office door, which, I confess, we briefly considered stealing. Mr. Godwin was a nice guy, an old man who was slowly losing his mind. He'd already lost his hair. He gave us a couple of half-assed lectures which, among other things, revealed to us that we were double-arrow buddies. You see, some friendships are mostly one way. Mr. Godwin diagrammed a one-way friendship on the blackboard. He drew two stick figures with an arrow pointing from figure A to figure B. In this case, A needs the friendship of B. A makes all the moves. B likes A, but if A stopped making most of the moves, B would drift away. Now sometimes you get a friendship like C and D. He drew two more stick figures on the blackboard, labeled C and D. There was an arrow pointing from figure C to figure D, and another arrow pointing from figure D to figure C. Here, C needs the friendship of D, just like A needed B. But D also needs the friendship of C, and so they are double arrow buddies. Smirk. It became a private joke. Well, John, I wouldn't do this for just anybody, but since you're my double arrow buddy. Poor Mr. Godwin. When he retired, I think they pushed him out. We sent a card signed with a double arrow. But I think he was right about one thing. Our sign stealing, our petty vandalism, as he called it, and of course that's what it really was, our petty vandalism was motivated not by want or need, who needs signs, and not by resentment. Well, there was a little resentment, but mainly we were motivated by friendship. It was something we could do together. And friendship, Mr. Godwin said, and I mean friendship with a capital F, is a noble motivation indeed, and a rare one. Besides the night we were arrested and the day Kennedy was shot, the only other excitement in high school was Miss Putz. She was a sweet old lady with a kind face and striking white hair. She taught 12th grade English. We called her Putt Putt Putz because she drove a little Morris Minor that sounded like a toy. John and I had both been burned in English. We'd always liked to read, but suddenly, in 11th grade, we were supposed to study the books. Not just read them and remember the plot and the names of the characters, but also analyze them, recognize symbols and themes. Suddenly, books became puzzles to solve, and plots became moral feces. We hated it. We barely passed. Then, in 12th grade with Miss Putz, I somehow couldn't take it seriously anymore. I started making fun of the work. I found a cigarette to be a death symbol, and telephone poles were crosses for Christ to bear, and pencils were sex symbols, and on and on. John picked it up, and soon we were finding symbols in toenails and punctuation marks. Putt-Putt loved it. English became our favorite class. We couldn't believe our success.
I detect a note of irreverence,
Miss Putz would say, if we laid it on a bit too heavy, but as long as we sounded vaguely reasonable, she'd beam with approval. Once, when I compared drinking a glass of water with a symbolic attempt to drown oneself, she said,
Willie, are you making fun of me?
And I said no. I wasn't making fun of her. I liked her. It was the subject that was ridiculous. One day, Miss Putz bought a gun and drove to her sister's house. Her sister was dying of cancer, hopelessly suffering. Putt-Putt shot her twice in the head, then drove to the parking lot of a shopping center where she wrote a grammatically perfect note in elegant script, and then, right there in the front seat of the Morris Minor between the Kmart and the A&P, she put the gun to her heart. We were stunned. Teachers don't do that sort of thing, especially English teachers, especially sweet old ladies. We analyzed the suicide note.
Could not bear to see any more suffering.
Bear, B-E-A-R,
John said,
a pun on B-A-R-E, bearing the truth. Bear as her ass.
We were drinking bad whiskey in John's basement, trying desperately to be witty and smug.
My sister faced a certain death. It was only a question of time.
My sister, I said. Like my brother, meaning we are all sisters and brothers in the family of man, facing certain death, only a question of time. If time is a question, what is the answer? John made a face.
I'm sick of this bullshit.
Me too. We never played the English game again. We sent flowers to Miss Putt's funeral, signing the card with a double arrow. After we went away to college, we never saw each other. We didn't even phone or write letters. Whatever had held us together in high school, being smartasses, for example, didn't apply anymore, and to be friends in college, we'd have to start all over. I guess neither of us wanted to make the effort. Anyway, there were geographical problems. John went to Yale and then to medical school in St. Louis. I went to a small Midwestern college where I was initiated into the pleasures of hemp, which grew wild near the campus. Unfortunately, these were still the Dark Ages, and my good citizen roommate reported me to the dean. I was dismissed. Soon, I was drafted. After boot camp, I drove a bulldozer in Vietnam until one night a sergeant asked me if I wanted to turn $200. I would be given a pass. I would drive a truck to Saigon and back. One night's work. $200. I went. I got stopped by some MPs. The truck was full of black market cigarettes. I spent 6 months in a sweltering stockade. Sleeping in the bunk below me was Cro-Magnon, a man who'd killed 10 American soldiers, two of them after he'd been put in the stockade. I was a bit nervous. Once I saw Cro-Magnon walk into a wall by mistake. He demanded an apology. The wall refused. Cro-Magnon swore at the wall, calling it every name in the army vocabulary. The wall ignored him. Finally, he hit the wall. He punched it again and again. The guards had to carry him away. I slept lightly, knowing he was down there. The only amusement in the stockade was racing cockroaches. We each had our pet roach, which we kept in a jar and fed with our own bread. We pampered our bugs as long as they ran for us. If one balked, though, even if it was a star runner, if it balked just once, we had the law of the camp. If you don't run, you don't live. We'd stomp the son of a bitch right there on the starting line. I've thought about that law. I think it says a lot. After 6 months, they let me out with a dishonorable discharge. I'd entered the army less than 2 years before, so I felt like I'd put one over on Uncle Sam. I'd gotten out 4 months early. My father said he couldn't pull any strings, but there must have been one thin piece of twine because he got me a job washing test tubes and cleaning rat cages. Home was unbearable. My parents tried. After all, they were liberals, but I guess I'd simply outgrown the whole scene. I saw an index card on a bulletin board asking for riders to help with driving to San Francisco. I went. Being a skilled and experienced technician, I soon found a job in San Francisco, washing test tubes and cleaning rat cages. I had a room in the Fillmore District. At that time, San Francisco was in the forefront of a chemical revolution, and I joined the peasants who were storming the Bastille. At the same time, I was spending every spare moment at work watching how they operated their little computer, which was next door to the rat room. It was easy. Soon, I talked my way into operating and doubled my salary. After a few months, they installed a bigger computer, and I was promoted to operate it. I'd moved in with a painter named Melinda, who was pretty fond of amphetamines, and soon I was fond of them, too. I talked my way into operating a 360-65, which at that time was probably the biggest machine in the city. I had a flair for the work. I was also zooming on speed. One day, Melinda went out for some wine and never came back. A few days later, I dropped acid and walked through a plate glass window. I decided to cool it. When my wounds had healed, I took a bus to Boston. I found a job operating a 360-50 for an insurance company. I didn't cool it. I was an out-and-out speed freak, skinny and shaking. I lived next to a nice couple named Jim and Mary. Nice, but terrible judges of character. One day, Mary said a friend of theirs wanted to buy some hash. I told them I didn't deal, but I could get some and sell it at cost. Their friend was no friend. It was a setup. My father flew up to Boston and told me he'd help if I agreed to go to this place in the mountains where I could be cured. If not, I could rot in jail. Naturally, I agreed. His lawyer beat the rap, illegal entrapment, and off I went to the mountains. It was a nice old resort in the Appalachians that used to treat tuberculosis before penicillin came along. Now it used the same treatment, clean air and cold nights, for drug addicts. The sign over the driveway said, Mushroom Mountain Sanitarium. I lived in a big white house on a hill surrounded by pine trees. At night, I slept under an open window covered by heavy wool blankets. Ever since, I've always loved the smell of wool. I used to lie in bed and count the shooting stars and listen to the owls and the rustle of the night. One of the other patients was named Erica. She was only 15. She wasn't an addict, but she'd had some weird kind of reaction to LSD. Maybe she was allergic to it, or maybe it was bad acid, some animal tranquilizer, or God knows what, and she'd lost the coordination in her fingers, and sometimes she'd have spasms run through her body from head to toe. The spasms were creepy. It looked like an orgasm, but there was fear in her eyes. Erica and I would climb the mountain to a lake where she taught me how to fish. We were usually the only people there. We'd fish and picnic and skip stones and make love, and if we caught anything, we'd fry it on a fire. Erica could talk to the birds. If she heard a dove, she'd sit on a rock and coo. Coo, coo, coo. And it would coo back from far away. Coo, coo. And she'd coo again. And the dove would answer from a closer tree, coo, coo, coo. And she'd coo again, and the dove would come closer, coo, coo. And closer, coo, coo, coo. Until it was sitting on a branch right over her head. She went home before me. She gave me her address in Wheeling, West Virginia. When I got out a month later, I took a bus to Wheeling and got a job operating a UNIVAC for a bank. I had to lie about my background, but a good operator is hard to find. I hoped that as soon as the bank saw how good I was, they'd forget about checking references. Erica was living with her parents in an old gray row house shaded by elm trees on a cliff above the Ohio River. The front porch had a chair hanging by a chain from the roof. And you could swing in the chair and watch the river go by. I was living in a flop house down by the bus station. The only other tenants were winos and burned-out prostitutes. They were all psychopaths. They were screaming and door-slamming all night long. When I wasn't at work, I tried to spend every minute with Erica. Her parents came from Harlan County, Kentucky. Her dad played fiddle, and her mother played a mean harmonica. Erica sang. I told them they should write to a record company and sign a contract. They didn't think they were any good. They just wanted to have a good time. Her dad was happy driving a delivery truck for Coca-Cola. He was a Teamster and proud of it. When Erica got pregnant, her folks wanted me to move in. Instead, I took her to a justice of the peace and then to an apartment I'd found in another part of town. She didn't like it. Too far from the river, she said. But she moved in with me. The baby came out strange. It was blue and didn't cry and looked like a moron. It died after 2 weeks. I was sorry it had turned out that way, but I was glad it had died. Erica was brokenhearted. She blamed it on the LSD. She blamed it on me. She blamed it on the apartment that was too far from the river. One day she split. I called her folks. They hadn't seen her. 3 days later, she was picked up in Pittsburgh. They sent her home. She went to live with her parents. She was having spasms again. I tried to get her to go fishing with me or to go up to the mountains to talk with the birds. She refused. Her coordination got worse. Her folks sent her back to the sanitarium in the mountains. She lost weight, and when I visited, she wouldn't see me. I was going mad. I loved her, but she was driving me crazy, and I obviously wasn't doing her any good either. I had to go. If you don't run, you don't live. I hitchhiked to Cincinnati, then decided to try hopping a freight. I'd never done it. I walked around the train yard looking for a good long train. I figured the more cars, the more likely it would be a long-distance run. I saw one pulling out that was so long I couldn't see the engine or the caboose. I ran alongside and climbed onto a flat car that had a truck trailer lashed to it. That was a mistake. I was exposed to the wind and the sun, and somebody could spot me. As soon as the train stopped for the first time, I selected a boxcar. It was nice. For the rest of the day, I sat by the open door of the boxcar while the land rumbled past my eyes. I pretended I was sitting still, and the land was moving. In the evening, the train stopped in Vincennes, Indiana. I was hungry, so I got off and found a cafe. After supper, I felt so good that I just wanted to walk down the tracks. Dry autumn grass was hanging over the gravel, and swallows were swooping and diving. I didn't know it at the time, but this was my last night as a legal citizen. The air smelled clean and crisp and full of life. I slept in an abandoned railroad station. Occasionally through the night, a long freight would clatter on by, shaking me awake from the pillow of dust. For the rest of the night, there was only the sound of dry grass scraping in the wind, and a mysterious machine that I could hear somewhere beneath the floorboards. What the machine did, I'll never know. The station was locked, waterless, abandoned. The town had died and disappeared. And yet, every 5 minutes or so, this cursed electric motor would whistle to a start, hum along for several seconds, and drive a piston, clank, 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 until it shook the floorboards. Then it shut itself off and lay dormant for another 5 minutes or so, while the grass scraped and the wind blew. To me, that machine symbolizes the Midwest, and I often think of it even today. A persistent, mysterious industrial force coming to life and dying again and again amid the land of wind and dry grass. St. Louis. Sam the trucker had a box of big white pills. He called them white lightning. I'd heard of the L.A. turnaround, a pill truckers used to drive New York to Los Angeles and back, but white lightning was something new. "Help self," Sam said, grinning, wagging a toothpick, tapping a ring on the steering wheel. "Why not?" I knew good and well why not, but I popped one anyway. It left a chalky white dust on my fingers. I bit. It tasted like kerosene and guano and bat's whiskers. And when I swallowed, my stomach growled with rage. But my head sang. It was no Benny. Soon my mind raced forward and ran circles around the conversation. Sam was recalling how he grew up on a chicken farm in East Texas, while my fingertips felt heavy and numb. Chicken farming was failing, and Sam's parents were dying as we rolled over Illinois flatlands, so when he inherited half the farm, he traded it for a truck. Land for wheels. He knew every cat house from Boston to New Orleans, every backroom casino from Miami to Seattle, every grimy truck stop from Chicago to San Diego. He was full of it. I let him talk. Words were music, and I tapped my heavy toes. But with white lightning, I could think whole sentences between each word that he uttered. And the sentences were thoughts that I didn't want to hear. I am running away from love. I am a coward. I am a rat. Sam delivered the soybeans and myself to a mill in East St. Louis.
"There's an easy-going cat house behind a bar, Ernie's, on 38th Street."
"Yeah? Thanks."
"See you there. Hoo-wee!"
but I had no intention. I wanted to be west of the Mississippi. Magic words. And there she was, Big Muddy, shimmering in afternoon sunlight, and beyond her I could see brown balls of smog rolling under the gateway arch. I knew somebody in St. Louis. John, my double arrow buddy. For all these years he'd been chipping away at the mountain of knowledge, and soon he'd be king of the rock pile. A doctor! And what had I done with those years? What had I gained? What did I know? I wondered how John would react after all this time. Could I speak to John, please?
Speaking?
Hey, John, this is your old double arrow buddy.
Huh?
Willie, remember?
Oh?
I almost hung up. I was talking into a tunnel 7 years long, standing alone in a phone booth in a city I did not know. John?
Oh, Willie! Willie! Hey, where are you?
John was fine. He was married, and he smoked a pipe. He lived on the third floor of an odd apartment building on Pershing Avenue. I guess you can figure the age of the building by the name of the street. Lucy, his wife, said they didn't use architects in those days. The builders slapped up walls on a whim. In their apartment, the back door was in the bathroom instead of the kitchen. To take out the garbage, you had to squeeze between the toilet and the bathtub. John wanted to take me out for dinner. We walked up the block and around the corner to a place called Romy's. The sidewalks were full of students. Romy's was on a corner directly across from the university, but inside the pizza joint were only expressionless men and hard-looking women. I asked John why the students didn't eat here. He shrugged. He'd never been here before. The waitress threw the menus at us. She slopped the water glasses and didn't wipe up the puddles. I ordered a beer with the pizza, and then another. I was coming down from White Lightning, and I needed to hold my head together. A man in dark glasses seemed to be in charge of the jukebox. Every once in a while, he'd cruise over and punch a few buttons. Sinatra and Tom Jones. I told John what I'd been doing with my life, and he told me about a summer in Europe and another working as a waiter in Yellowstone National Park. Other than that, he'd simply been going to school. And Lucy, who was in graduate school in anthropology, had spent her summers with her folks on Nantucket Island. Incredible! I thought of all the things I'd done in the last 7 years, and here these two were still students, still going to school, still being told what to do. I looked up from our conversation to see a shaggy-haired kid shuffle in and over to the jukebox. As he leaned into the glow of the machine to read the selections, you could see that he'd patched the back of his old sheepskin jacket with an American flag. Conversation stopped. The man in dark glasses started walking for the jukebox. At the tables, the men remained expressionless. The women didn't show a glint of feeling in their eyes. Dark Glasses was standing behind the kid. The kid was leaning over the machine. Suddenly, Dark Glasses attacked. He slammed the kid to the wall and punched him in the jaw. I got up. I wasn't thinking. I jumped on the man and shoved him to the floor. The kid saw his chance and ran out the door. Great! I couldn't handle this guy alone. I saw John getting up. I waved him away. He's no fighter. I backed toward the door. The man advanced. Behind him, two men stood up and unbuttoned their jackets. I made it through the door and shoved it back. I was lucky. The door swung back and caught Dark Glasses on the chin. He staggered but recovered. Before I could get away, he rushed out. He lunged, caught my collar, swung me around. He raised his fist, tightened it. He was wearing a ring. The other two men stood right behind him. The scene, the three faces locked into my mind. The fist was an inch from my nose. The ring was gold with jagged edges. While I was watching his fist, dark glasses kicked me in the groin. I fell to the sidewalk, doubled over. I heard the sound of cloth ripping and thought it was me. Then I looked up and saw the two men running away. Dark glasses was falling. There was a shiv in his back. I didn't understand, but I knew it was bad. I managed to stand up and limp into an alley. I heard voices. "He stabbed Frank! He stabbed him in the back!" I staggered down the alley. Already I heard sirens. I came out on a street. A bus was coming. I got on. I was shaking. I wanted to throw up. After a while, I got off. I didn't know where I was. The street was dirty and lined with old brick duplexes. My balls ached, and there was a dull thumping between my ears. I saw a police car. I panicked. I ran between two buildings and ducked down a stairwell. I sat on the bottom step and wondered what I could do. Before I decided, I passed out.
Leonard and Clyde, just out of jail. Clyde picked his nose with a 10-penny nail.
That's the end of this episode. This is Joe Cottonwood, along with the voice of Susan Walker. The music is by Will Fort.
Mother America, what have you done? All of your children are out on the run. Mother America, we say, can you see? Life's so short, we got to be free. Hey, life's so short, we got to be free.
A podcast is like a virtual street performance, and like a street performer, I have a tip jar. The tip jar is located at clearheartblog.blogspot.com. I thank you.